Tabletopped will start after the following messages.
Many miles from here, past all the hustle and bustle of your town, past the mountains and hills, across the rivers and through the forest, there is a meadow. In this meadow are several divots and burrows housing a large and united warren of bunnies.
Well, one day I'm going to go out into the forest and I'm going to meet the forest gods myself.
Why are you showing me this? What does this have to do with me and what's going on in the warren?
It does puzzle me a little bit why the stories from different storytellers are different.
So we're in agreement.
Yes.
I'll see you at the lunch bell.
Bunnies and Burrows, the next Game Master Monday miniseries begins May 6th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone, to another episode of Tabletopped. I'm your host, Nick, and today I have two very special guests on, journalists Rowan Zioli and Chase Carter. Thanks so much for coming on, both of you. This is going to be so exciting. I really hope that my lack of professionalism when it comes to interviewing is not shown up by your years of experience. But first, let me kind of tell folks who you are. They've been covering TTRPGs and culture for years in many different publications. Perhaps you've heard of some of them, Polygon, Dicebreaker, others. And recently, along with their co-founder, Lynn Codega, they have launched Rascal News, a news site dedicated to continuing the vital work of investigating the TTRPG industry, while also building a space for criticism, culture reporting, and lighthearted blogs. Perhaps you guys recognize that. It's right off your about page. But welcome, both of you. How are you?
Yeah,
thank
doing
you so
well
much for having us.
Yeah, of course.
This is so exciting. I'm really excited to kind of dive in. Rascal has kind of been exploding on some social medias. If people haven't seen, you should check out their website. It's going to be in the show notes if you're interested. But can you guys tell me where Rascal came from? What started Rascal?
Yeah, the idea, at least like for me, and I think like Rowan has a similar story, is that Lynn reached out, and mine was like a two sentence email. It was just like, hypothetically, if I had some money to pay you for a job, would you be interested? And how much money would it need to be? Which is always an email you love to get from a peer. I think like the actual answer is that Rascal rises out of all of our sort of like concerted discontent with the digital media, and the fact that if we didn't have our current jobs, and if you're Rowan, not even that current job, like full-time position, there's just nothing else. And in an environment where we're seeing media companies lay off like, you know, swaths of people all throughout 2023 and even more in 2024, we sort of said to ourselves, like, if we don't build it, it will never come to us. There's not going to be any earning that position, no earning that sort of like position out of constant precarity. So, I mean, like, caution to the wind, let's do the thing ourselves.
Yeah, pretty much that's the whole thing. I, as opposed to Chase and Lynn, who have been had established staff writing jobs at places over the course of the last like decade or so, I graduated college in 2020 into a world on fire and have never had a non-freelance gig. I have always, except for when I worked at an unnamed big brand coffee shop during high school, I have always been a freelance worker. And so having a stable job writing any capacity has never been a thing that I thought was possible. I was doing a lot of volunteer journalism prior to this. I was doing some work with the Fandamentals, where I really got to dive into like indie actual play. I did like the freelance work at Polygon, but Polygon only has so much money for freelance, which is now getting increasingly diminished with every passing quarter. And so I had another job doing journalism, and that didn't work out very well. And then Lynn reached out to me, who had been really lovely about like championing me through some very difficult processes of that other job, was then like, hey, you're a great journalist. I'm a great journalist. People will pay us money to do it if we ask them for it. Looking at like Aftermath, Defector, all of the other worker-owned outlets that have popped up in the last year or so, and being like, why not us? And that's just kind of how it happened. And then we spent some time on the phone being like, okay, what name should we come up with? And we were just like pitching
this
out ideas.
This is my next exact question is, where did the name Rascal come from? Is it just because you all felt like you were kind of, you know, Dennis the Menacing, the TTRPG news industry, or just the news industry in general by putting forward a worker-owned model and trying to move away from kind of being owned by these billionaires and all that kind of stuff? Where did this name come from?
To be honest, I think the name came from a conversation that Lynn had on the Reckless Atalk podcast, where they were deemed a rascal in like the description and like the conversation there. And then I brought it up as like a joke during that initial conversation being like, we should call it Rascal. And then like, aha, yeah. We had another idea for a name that kind of just like fell to the wayside because it was already taken by a different TTRPG outlet. Mm. We were like, ah, well, that's not going to work. But like that, yeah. And so then it just like what started as a joke, as a bit, we committed to the bit and now we're here.
Yeah, Rascal does sort of become aspirational in our, because like Lynn's from like upstate New York by way of Appalachia. I'm in the South. So except for like our resident like New Yorker here, like we all sort of have like and even then New York even has their sort of like intrepid vermin that like persist almost out of spite, you know, like we got possums, we've got raccoons, but like there's something very aspirational about these creatures that sort of are given trash and yet thrive nonetheless, and will bite the ankles of things bigger than them when given the chance. And I think that's what we really want to.
That is Brooklyn in a nutshell.
Yeah. For sure. If you all don't know Scripted Games, you really have to talk to them. They released a game last year, I think, called Psychic Trash Detectives, where it's just all of the what you just described. Essentially, you are a trash animal, which is a specific genre of like character in this world, and you solve mysteries. It's really wonderful, but that's, I think, delightful. That you all would really get along. Yeah, that's amazing. And I really, something that's really, I'm really passionate about is sort of the worker owned model. And I mean, Chase, you've been covering sort of labor politics in the space for a long time. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of tell about how Rascal decided upon its model and how it's planning to move forward with that as well?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we didn't start with a worker-owned model. We did start sort of pursuing a bit of like outside funding, some capital. And what quickly became apparent beyond the fact that it would take us a long time to find those people, like we're saying probably a couple of years at best to like connect with money, in having those conversations with even a person or two who had best interests at heart, we realized that we were sacrificing a lot of freedom and a lot of sort of autonomy that undermined the vision of what we wanted for Rascal, as far as just like who we would cover, how we would cover them, trying to get away from that ad-driven model and the sort of like, you know, capitalist-driven model of journalism. And so I think at a certain point we said, we can either try to do this ourselves, essentially build the plane as it leaves the runway and just sort of like stick to our morals, stick to our ethics, or we can spend a lot of more time to try to do this in a more traditional way. And at a certain point we said, no, it matters more that we do this the way we want to do it from the jump. And so the way that Rascal own sort of operates now is that we are all three co-owners and we call ourselves co-bosses in the Discord. And so we have like a sort of like, you know, equal stake. We are, as we get set up, I think Lynn has sort of been the business person who holds a lot of keys to like, say, the bank accounts and finances and all that sort of stuff. But that's just because their brain works better for that than me and Rowan, whose ADHD brains just go to any sort of obligation or like deadline. So, but like that ethos is at the center of it, where we're like, any decision that we make is made in solidarity with all three of us. When we talk about, say, contributors, or freelancers, or bringing on a fourth rascal in the far future, like that is going to be done not as like a sort of junior member or some sort of subcategory, but like an equal sort of flat hierarchy where they get to buy in fully to this project that we're building.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think that is such a point that you made in there, was like, we could start this on the right foot, essentially. And I think that is really important, especially as the TTRPG G space really is becoming a much more profitable space for a lot of businesses. I mean, like, you know, Hasbro is doing its best to prove that wrong, but a lot of companies and people are coming into the space and making actual plays. There are production companies behind these things now. There's a lot more TTRPGs on the market. So I think it's also really great that you guys are really starting a company that doesn't have attachments to all of that, so that you can, you know, be an honest, you know, caller of balls and strikes when it comes to, you know, the industry. But what do you all think about the sort of the stated goal of Rascal? So you were talking about like what the vision was and what you guys really wanted to do. And I'm really curious, what is your, you know, what does it look like in a year? What does it look like in 5 years? What are you hoping for in the best case scenario? What is Rascal a place for, so that when people will stop by, what can they expect?
You want to start off with this? Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I think Rascal, very much like us, we're like very much a champion of the little guy in the space. We very much want to like platform and uplift the work of people who don't have these big backings of these studios and these corporations, who are doing this as their passion project, who are doing this as like they are trying to make it a career, but the systems of discoverability aren't quite there yet, because again, like ad-driven, SEO-driven content doesn't really cater towards non-big name brands. But also like in the long term, we want to make this like a sustainable incubator for journalists in the space. Like, I have been a journalist a lot less time than both Chase and Lynn, and we've already established like a very like educational learning as we go model. And I have, despite the fact that I've been doing journalism for like a year and a half, almost 2 years, I've learned much more having an actual mentor process than I had just being in a freelance position of being like, yeah, someone write this and then give it back to us. And then we'll tell you, we'll give you some copy edits and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, when I look at the, I think when I look at the space of like journalism for the tabletop industry, you have two options as it stands right now, which is like the sort of like more traditional model, which is like Dicebreaker, Polygon, Wargamer, Christian Hoffer over at Comic Book. You know, it's folks like this who are working within an industry that is established. It comes from, you know, digital media, Gawker, like all of these sort of sites that just sort of like went from blogging in the 2000s up to like digital publications. And that was a great model up until like sort of ads sort of choked any sort of like life out of it and slapped it to a machine that said like profitability above all else. And if you don't do that, you do like Board Game Geek forums, YouTube channels, podcasts, which is not to denigrate anybody who does that sort of stuff. You know, I'd be spitting in the face of our host if we did that, but it is not, it is not journalism in the way that like an industry that is making more money every year sort of needs and deserves. And so we're positioning Rascal to be a third option, which is like, we unshackle ourselves from like, say playing Google's game and like sorting all of our headlines and all of our stories to the algorithm. We do not have to worry about discoverability or page count numbers or anything like that. By doing a subscriber model, something that is funded by our readers directly, we hope that people are giving us money because they want us to write what we feel is important. They're looking to us as voices of authority within the space to tell them what they need to know and to give them a perspective that is a little bit different from what you might say there. And it gives us the ability to just like write some shitty blogs every once in a while just for fun, like, you know. So yeah, Rascal is like a third option to the way journalism can work in this space. And I think it's a necessary one, because when we don't have to worry about upsetting too many sort of like advertisers, we can make those call shots. We can bite the ankles. We don't have a lot of power, but asking questions in the right space can be a powerful tool.
Yeah. One thing I really wanted to ask both of you too regarding that is, you mentioned, you know, you're hoping that the subscribers and the reading base is looking to you to you know, cull through all of the stories and the information and find the things that are actually important and put it in front of them. So I would love to take this chance to let, you know, the listenership kind of get to know you two a little bit more. What is your sort of relationship with TTRPGs, the AP space, like all of this sort of genre of stuff? What matters to you? What do you think is really interesting in the space right now? Just so that they know what they're getting when they start heading to Rascal News and start signing up.
Chase.
Yeah, sure. I can like lead this off. Like, For me, like, I come to tabletop through, like, video game journalism, honestly. Like, that's where I cut my teeth as far as doing, like, entertainment journalism. And I'd always been interested in tabletop in such a fashion that, like, I played Dungeons & Dragons games and Gamma World with my friends. Like, we did some Pathfinder whenever we got sick of Dungeons & Dragons. I was always interested in some of the indie games that were floating around, but never, like, bought myself fully in because I didn't know where to go for that stuff. It was, if you weren't playing D&D, like, it was a niche thing. And then in like 2017, I got on like Google Plus, whenever like Google Plus and Circles were really big, and tabletop latched on to that sort of stuff. And I was in it for the last year before Google Circle sort of imploded, and I watched all that sort of fade away. And so I didn't really touch it for a while until 2020 in the pandemic, when I like lost my job at a publication in Dallas, and picked up a sort of like just freelance gig for Matt Jarvis over at Dicebreaker. And I was just like, yeah, I know enough about like RPGs. I'm a news writer. Something I believe is that like you need to come from a specialized place. Having specialized knowledge is better. It's easier to like instill in someone or have someone have, rather than a writing skill. You can teach someone to write. And I was like, yeah, I know enough about RPGs and like sort of entertainment space that I can glom onto this. And it was a crash course in sort of like learning the industry, because I wasn't just doing RPGs. I was doing board games and card games and war games and stuff like that. So now 3.5 years in, like I've sort of just sort of trained myself on a lot of this industry knowledge, on a lot of history. And a lot of that history happens in online spaces that don't exist anymore, whether we're talking about the Forge and forums, or we're talking about Google Plus circles, or we're talking about Twitter threads that are just sort of lost to the ether. Or now it's like Discord communities that if you're not a part of, you don't know if they happen. Like I could go on for an hour about like the way that we talk about information and why we need to bring back forums. But that's sort of how I come to it. And so like, I mean, RPGs are like, in covering like news, like they are very similar to say music or video games or comics or anything else. They are an enthusiast space where you're, like, player base is probably more informed than the casual consumer. They know a lot and they know how to seek that information out on their own. So you have to find a way to talk about them in a way that isn't just, here's the thing that's happening and here's details about it, because they know that stuff already. They're looking at press releases. They're in the Kickstarter like comments asking all these questions about like, oh, I see that you're using this distributor that's based in like Ontario. If you use the one in China, it's a lot better. And it's like, homie, you're a single person. Like, you're talking to someone with like 100 employees. What are you doing? It's pretty wild. So more so, what I want to try to do at Rascal, and what I think doesn't exist, is more cultural criticism, more sort of impression stuff, more sort of like labor reporting, which is what I sort of like to do a lot of. And so this is a long-winded answer to say, like, RPGs need to grow up, and I really hope to be someone to sort of foster that maturation as it goes forward.
Yeah, kind of jumping off of that, actually, I am the resident Gen Z of the Rascal team. And as everyone knows, Gen Z is vocally radical and frustrated and angry, as mm-hmm. am I. And the thing that I think is really unique about the tabletop space being so decentralized, aside from like the big dragon in the room, being so decentralized, being so new, being so still developing, is that like we kind of have the option to develop whatever kind of economic ecosystem and social ecosystem that we want. We don't just have to take the old ways of doing things. And reporting on people who are doing new things in the space, people who are focusing on this community-oriented folk art, which TTRPGs and actual plays are, and then using the systems that exist and subverting them and trying to create more equitable models of artistic creation is really, really important to me. And so making sure that I'm honing in on that, reporting on that, because so much of that happens both unpaid and unreported. And like Chase just said, it like disappears into the ether forever. And so being able to go like, no, other ways are possible and you can have fun while doing those things. And so bringing that all together in the world of gaming, which like TTRPGs are uniquely situated that we all engage in world building every single time we play a game, as opposed to like video games or other mediums of art where you are existing within a world that has been created for you and given to you. You are engaging in the act of creation. And so that's unique and special. And I think that's why it deserves the kind of dedicated space that Rascal provides it.
Great. And right after this break, I'm going to start really grilling you guys on the news of the day, try to see what your takes on of the these things are and kind of pick your brains about the industry in general. We'll be back right after this.
Yeah, let's do it.
Are you the kind of person or unspeakable nightmare horror who likes actual play podcasts, but occasionally wants a break from all the high fantasy heroics? If so, you should check out Negative Modifier, an actual play podcast that specializes in darker, more mature games. You can find us on YouTube, Twitch, or more or less anywhere else podcasts can be found.
Hey everyone, it's me, Nick, from the Tabletop Podcast. When I'm not hosting, I'm thinking about ways to create a better podcast for you guys, and I think I landed on something pretty fun. In fact, if you go to our Patreon at patreon.com/tabletopped and join for as little as a dollar a month, you can get access to a new episode a month that we're going to start putting out. In fact, we're going to be calling this one Wild Magic, I think, in that we're going to talk about anything and everything that interests us, not just TTRPGs, though there will be a lot of that. It is truly unhinged, and if you are a fan of the podcast and all of the hosts, you're definitely going to want to be on it. We're thinking of dropping these at the end of each month, so join our Patreon today. That is patreon.com/tabletopped. Oh, and there's going to be so much more coming out in the new year there, so don't miss it. Sign up today. Welcome back to Tabletop. Today I
great
have
podcast
two...
read. Great ad. So good.
It was so. Oh, I can't believe it, man. I've never wanted to
right
buy
now.
Bitcoin. Yeah, I've never wanted to buy Bitcoin,
wait,
but now
on.
I'm in.
Roll it back. Roll it back. I did not say that.
Wait. Did you guys ever think about NFTs like that? Wow. We're back. We're back with two of the rascals of Rascal News. We are talking to Rowan Zioli and Chase Carter about everything around TTRPG and culture today. And now I want to throw some stuff at you so that you guys can kind of talk to the audience a little bit about what you think about this stuff. The big one, I think, is going to your point, Chase, about the kind of maturation of the industry, is what are the biggest hurdles for the TTRPG space and the actual place moving into 2024? I mean, this is very broad, but you can narrow it down to, you know, what issues you think that the industry is going to have as we go in, like labor and all that kind of stuff. Or we can talk a little bit more about like what communities and what stories you think haven't been getting a lot of attention. So we'll start with Chase and then we'll move to Rowan.
Yeah, I mean, as an industry, tabletop is really stratified. You have one to two companies that sort of capture all of the pop culture attention and therefore all that sort of like mass market money. And then you have what I think they like to see themselves as is like a sort of cadre of starving artists sort of waggling their fingers at the industry and, you know, finding a way to be okay with being poor. And that's because like it's just... what else is there? I think like one of the things that tabletop is going to have to sort of reckon with is that it's an industry that is trying to mature very quickly in a model of capitalism that is just sort of coming apart at the seams. Video games had the benefit of starting in like the 90s and 2000s and sort of like, you know, the tech booms of those eras, whereas tabletop had COVID as a sort of, you know, catalyst of growth. And it was a catalyst of growth when you look at tabletop sort of writ large. But there's no way for that money to trickle down, if I'm going to use like a Reagan era term, if that ever really works in the first place. Like, reader, it doesn't, let me tell you. So...
I never really pegged you, Chase, as a Reaganite, but I guess we learn new things every
Chase
day.
Super into Reaganomics.
Take me back to the 1980s for sure. But like,
what public spaces can we hollow out?
I've never enjoyed a third space in my life. Just give me two. Give me home and work. That's all I need. But yeah, so like I think tabletop is really going to be sort of reckoning with the fact that there needs to be more space and more sort of like money for, like if to borrow a term for video games, like those AA studios, and we have them around. You have Free League, you have Paizo, you have Modiphius and Chaosium and all these other places that do pretty good, but they don't make a dent in the sort of pop culture capture of the imagination that Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast has. And I think they want to be the only name that people think of when they think of tabletop.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, for real. There's a really great indie developer named Fern Milton of Cobble Path Games. Mm-hmm. She was talking to me probably a year ago at this point about how really when you look at the industry and compare it to like the board game industry, you see a lot of like micro niches in the board game industry where it's like, oh, you want to play a game where you're, I don't know, like a capitalist building, you know, an 1800s business empire. There's a board game for that. But then for TTRPGs, it's like we have Dungeons and Dragons. You know what I mean? It's like there is the one and everyone kind of shoves their stories through this one system. And then I think on the other side of that, you have things like Powered by the Apocalypse, which is like a system that is essentially monetized in the way that developers are able to sell their systems. But that system at its core is completely free for everyone to develop on. So it's kind of like this kind of clashing of instincts within this, like you said, kind of new industry where people's intellectual property is kind of very, you know, murky about what is what. And like, to your point, Rowan, it's all kind of folk tradition down. I mean, the OGL was this. Mm-hmm. So like, what do you think when it comes to specifically like actual plays and the systems that are coming out? How is there ever going to be sort of a real industry around it when it is so murky to start with?
Well, I think, because Chase definitely took my point about the economics of it, because I think that's really a huge part of it. Yeah. I think the other element of it is the semi-social, semi-professional nature of the industry, which really prevents a lot of growth because there is this interweaving and intermeshing of the social dynamics and the professional dynamics and people not taking themselves professionally and the murky nature of like so many people don't get paid for their labor and so many people don't sign contracts that do get paid for their labor. And so like working on like handshake deals and like work and like trust of the other person can only go so far if you're working under these old systems and we're still existing under capitalism. So like, how are we going to break through to get actual play using other systems? It's just going to be people doing it. And like, on top of that is people doing it and people paying attention to doing it. Cause there absolutely is a tabletop game where you can play as an 18th century economic empire, like 100%, but people just don't know about it. Cause there's no discoverability. There are no resources for people to like figure out and sift through all of this. Like there is like for board games.
I think it's
just an unpacking and an understanding of like the way things were don't have to be the way things are.
I think that there is a really great point you had there, Rowan, too. So Dr. Emily Friedman came on the podcast like 6 months ago.
Love Dr. Friedman.
She's wonderful. Yeah, she's great. Mm-hmm. But she was talking about how a lot of the economic models of specifically actual plays are kind of from the beginning kind of dooming the show because they are of that sort of like, are you just my friend playing a game with me or are we going in on a business venture together? And when you compare it to these powerhouses like Dimension 20 or these are, you know, Critical Role or something that have huge amounts of money behind this stuff and a staff and all that kind of thing, you have people competing that are sort of in these weird spots of I'm doing this for free because I think it's fun, but now you're expecting me to be, you know, a worker in this organization, which is like a very weird spot to be. It seems kind of like an impossible thing to get off the ground.
Yeah, it really is. And it's because of the whole like misnomer of being, you know, friends at a table playing a game and not artists making art, because there is like this big dichotomy in actual play of people being like, no, we have to keep it pure. We have to make sure it's just people playing a game and then you're recording that and it's nothing else. And then on the other end, there's like, no, we're making an entertainment show and you need to make it highly stylized and highly intentional. There's Queen Court Games, which is a really great actual play production house, which has very solidly built an infrastructure for both itself and supporting other actual plays in the space by like providing their Crown Grant, which they just gave out, which got a bunch of people in Webfests. They have this phrase that I really enjoy called take yourself professionally, but not seriously, which is where like that semi-social, semi-professional model can gel, where you're like, yeah, we all treat each other with respect. We are equals. We're making sure that like we are responding to our obligations and fulfilling those obligations, but also with an understanding that like while we are operating under this capitalist model, we do have those obligations that like go past just the social contract that we need to ensure that we are protecting ourselves and protecting the people that we're working with.
Yeah.
And it's hard when so many people who, because of the boom in 2020, came out of doing this in their spare time of like, oh, I just want to play a game with someone. And the only way we can get people to play a game is because we're all brain rotted by the internet is if we make content about it. And so you're getting the people who are making content now realizing, oh, I can make this a career. But they're also not realizing that people who have made this a career, air quotes for this audio medium, made this a career. This isn't their full-time gig either. They are professional voice actors. They're professional improv comedians, which, again, a lucrative career choice. speaking as a former stand-up comedian myself.
Yeah, you just pierced me straight through as someone who, you know, has, you know, dipped their toes into improv comedy. Yeah, so I think that you're so right. I mean, to kind of peer behind the curtain of Tabletop, like, we do not have like a massive, you know, hundreds of thousands of people audience. I think that we get, you know, around 2,000 listeners a month. And that is within the top, like, you know, 60% of podcasts, like, generally. So like, even when things are like successful, it cannot, it doesn't always, you know, you're not sitting on riches and a mountain of gold. I think that sometimes, to your point, Rowan, like, through the lens of social media, it's very hard to tell that sometimes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of posturing in the space. There's a lot of like, because you have to play the game, like, capitalism has taught everyone that you have to fake it till you make it. You have to make sure that everyone is thinking that you're more successful than you are. But that then also leads to the difficulty of like, you can't speak out when you're struggling, or you can't be honest about like the realities of what it takes to make these kinds of art. And so being able to have that level of honesty and transparency, like, I think that translates over to journalism as well. Like, I think a lot of people are like, oh, being a journalist is such like a lucrative, wonderful career where you get to like get all this free stuff and you get to travel and write about these things. And God, we're so fucking poor. And we are very honest about that.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask both of you was, so both of you also have a background in kind of criticism when it comes to, you know, arts criticism, culture criticism, and also TTRPG criticism. One thing I wanted to ask was, you both were kind of talking about how discoverability of new TTRPGs is very low. I kind of wanted to ask you a two-pronged question of, one, how do you sort of like dip your toes and find those new things that are going to be become interesting things worth writing about when it comes to systems? And then also, how do you kind of grade a system? Like, what is the process that something gets filtered through? I know it's more art than science when it comes to this stuff, but what are the sort of things in your head that you go through?
Chase, you could talk to TTRPGs first, because I think I have an actual play perspective, but not quite a TTRPG perspective.
Yeah. I mean, for me as a journalist, discoverability is often, practically speaking, what hits my inbox. And I remember when it comes to writing about a game, if I like, I have a label and I have a whole folder where, like, you know, pitches and press kits go to. But as far as like, if I'm just the average like player looking to find a new game, like, your choices are like searching by new or hot on Kickstarter or itch.io with the physical game tag on there. Like, it's pretty slim pickings. The only other choice, which is what oftentimes people do, is you wait for it to pop up on Twitter. And that's not a good system, y'all. We got to find something else. And even then, like, itch.io, like, for all its like the good things that it does for smaller artists, like, discoverability has always been a big problem with that system. That platform was not built for discoverability, really. It was built for hosting games cheaply when you have no other option, for throwing up small little personal projects. And the infrastructure has just not caught up with like how we actually use it. So, man, like, this is like a big bugbear for me, which is Kickstarter and other crowdfunding platforms are kind of it as far as like remembering which projects, like it's like, oh, I follow this on BackerKit or Kickstarter, or I shipped this $25 a year ago. I just got an email that it's coming to my door and I haven't thought about this game in a year. It's not exactly great for, like, you know, a game where marketing needs to be part of the push. As for how I like review them, it is very holistic. This might be a very sort of like, this answer is probably not going to satisfy a lot of people, but like, it depends on the system. Like, you know, to say like, how do you review a game? It's just like, well, are we going to talk about like war games? Is this like a skirmish war game with some narrative elements attached to it? Is it closer to a lyric game where it's more of a, like an art project slash like treatise on game design that is barely playable? Or is it like a fantasy heartbreaker where I need to sort of pick apart what it's trying to do and what it's not trying to do before I look at the actual system and how it plays out? For me, often what I try to do is just like, what's the intent? I try to look past the rules and look past the interactions to go like, what is all of this telling me to do? What are the sort of stories that it's allowing players to tell? What are the sort of stories that it's explicitly saying this is not the space for? I think most tabletop RPGs and most games in general, like one of the things that makes them successful is to put bounds on the interactive space, on the possibility space, because a game that tries to be everything, D&D, is not going to do anything very well. So what is this thing trying to do?
Actually, sorry, we can't go on the record.
This is a podcast where it's very safe to say that sort of thing. We have some major problems with D&D. I think that one of our hosts still holds a soft spot in his heart about it, but most of us are like, yeah, we'll play anything else.
Yeah, so I think like one of my favorite reviews that I published over at Dicebreaker was for Into the Odd, whenever it came out. Mm. And I approached it from this sort of like a very vibes-based approach, because I think a lot of that game and a lot of OSR games in general, because mechanically they can be by design fairly slim, it's mostly about the sort of like vibes of the stories you're trying to tell, this sort of overall tone that it does at the table. And so I think I have to take like a sort of 100-mile back approach and be like, so I've got all these tools. It's almost like looking at a Lego set and you've got all the different pieces. It's like, what can I imagine building with these Legos? And then from there, begin to sort of piece together what's going on. Like, as I begin to put this together, what sort of emerges, what sparks my imagination, what sort of fires off in my synapses? And then, I mean, successful or unsuccessful, I don't know that I could do that in a review. I can tell you my experience with it and sort of like what I get out of it. But like, I think that's up to you. I think that's so subjective as to, you read my review, and if it sounds interesting, you go play it yourself. If you read it and you get angry saying like, this sounds like you didn't understand the game, go play it for yourself. In any case, I think my reviews should spark a curiosity to engage with it on your own terms and see what that art does for you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And Rowan, you were saying that for actual play, you have another sort of rubric.
Yeah, I think for actual play, the discovery process is a bit similar, because, again, Twitter is like the place where everyone is promoting their stuff, because that's the only place we have right now, especially because the other big outlets will not get permission from the powers that be to write about anything else. So I, like many other people, started with Critical Role Dimension 20 and went like, oh, this is a really cool thing. And then just through being on social media was like, okay, here are some other shows, here's some other people in the space, and kind of found through that. And then recommendations from those people, that kind of word of mouth spread, enabled me to like kind of widen that reach a little bit. But another really big element is, the Webfest circuit that has happened, that has really developed in the last year or so, like spearheaded by Ned Donovan, the actual play Webfest circuit. That's a very global Webfest circuit where you can get some actual plays from around the world, has really keyed me into some people doing some really cool stuff in the space. Being able to access it through that way has been really beneficial for me. But the way that I decide whether or not I'm going to write about an actual play tends to be a couple fold. It tends to be like, one, is the cast not homogenous? Like, is there a diversity of people on the cast, and or are they all just not white people? That's usually like kind of my bare minimum. But then also past that, it goes, okay, I give an actual play 5, maybe 10 minutes to really grip me, which is way more time than I think most people give any media that they're consuming to whether or not it'll grip them. And I think that's just the job of a critic in general, is to be like, okay, I gotta push past that initial like scroll brain instinct to just go off and do something else. But then after it initially grips me, if I'm like, okay, this seems like it's doing something interesting in the space, I have kind of a three-prong approach to deciding my rubric of how I like analyze it. it'll go from the like business perspective of like, is this done by a business? Is this done by an independent person? Is this done by a collective? How are they going about the production side of this? Is this just for marketing? Like, I have a review up on the site of Marvel TTRPG's actual play that they did with Glass Cannon Network, where I kind of tore it apart because it was just a marketing device that was masquerading as an actual play. What is its specific perspective that it has of being like, is this uniquely telling something as a story that maybe wouldn't be able to be told in other mediums? Are the people telling the story the right people to be telling the story? What are they trying to say through the specific medium of emergent play? And then the like technical aspect of this, because actual play is still a developing medium, how is it using the audio or visual language of other mediums? Or is it developing new techniques to do the storytelling in a very unique way? How is it pushing the medium forward? What traditions is it lying on? Is it like lying on the live stream tradition that Critical Role has kind of set up? Is it in the podcast tradition that The Adventure Zone has set up or Friends of the Table has set up? Is it in the like more edited, more like visually produced style of Dimension 20? Like, where is the craft lineage coming from? And then through all of those three things combined, being like, why does this matter? How does all of these three things intersecting speak to the larger culture that we are currently existing? Because all art responds to culture. And if it's not doing that, I don't have the position of being able to say any art is bad art, but it's just art that I'm not interested in writing about.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that that conversation kind of sparked in me in both of your answers, and Chase, I think that this might also be a little bit of a parallel to some of your work in video games, probably. But right now, it feels as though this industry is so wrapped up in cult of personality. Like, people are so, you know, attached to individual creators or individuals. I mean, we recently had the whole thing with Gabe Hicks come, like, being Me Too'd, and then that was an ouster from a company, and like that company's future is sort of in turmoil right now as that goes through everything. What do you both think about the future when it comes to that? Because in video games, it very much got corporatized, and that really got separated out, where it became like all of these people who are names like Ken Levine or whatever just sort of just got shunted to the side. And now there's, you know, Activision, and that's the big thing that people will think about. But right now I feel like TTRPGs is very much about individuals. And going back to your point, Rowan, about like how you find stuff, like Twitter is a social capital machine. Like, people who have big followings are able then to promote projects or to promote other people's projects. And then that's how people get momentum going. So where do you think the future lies when it comes to that in this industry? Do you think that we're kind of trapped in that for a little while longer? Do we think that we're going to move in more of the corporatized way? Or do you think something new might occur, because there is a little bit more of like a class consciousness or a social consciousness when it comes to this space specifically? There's like a lot of queer involvement. There's a lot of social justice involvement just from the ground level of what kind of games are being made. So where do you both see this going?
Rowan, go ahead, because I know this is a pet soapbox of yours.
Yeah, it is. It's the reason why I'm laughing is because I wrote a forbidden blog that will never be allowed to be published. It will never be allowed to be published. Because I don't think I say anything incorrect in it, but
unless
I don't want to
pay the $500 a month premium. I'm sure.
Yeah, if you single-handedly patronize me to pay my rent forever, then yes, absolutely, you can read it. But no, I really think that you're completely right, that there is a problem about cult of celebrity in the TTRPG space, but I don't think it's unique to the TTRPG space. You're mentioning it's happened in video games. I think it's an indication and like a condemnation of our larger culture, where if I can get real pretentious and academic for a second, Joseph Campbell.
We went real deep.
Joseph Campbell, in like his book Pathways to Bliss, has this whole big idea that because we no longer have a like shared monomyth, we no longer have a shared cultural like deity, we have each created our own little deities. We've each created our own little ways and like look to these like celebrity figures as ways to guide and navigate our own lives in the ways that these figures did in the past. And now we have decentralized everything so much to this degree that we have turned celebrities into our like guiding moral figures a little bit. So they're telling us who to support, what to follow. And like you said, it's going to kind of collapse in on itself eventually. I am maybe naively hopeful that I do believe it can change. I think there is going to be a reckoning at some point, however many cycles that takes, where people are going to realize that putting people on pedestals is only putting them up in the future to fall, that there is no other option because we are all humans. Just putting someone on a pedestal doesn't make them a god, doesn't make them an infallible figure. And the best option out of that is something that hasn't been thought of yet, or has been thought of probably by a lot of writers and a lot of thinkers and a lot of abolitionists. But the ingrained ideas of how the world is supposed to work and the way that we are supposed to be led and not supposed to individually be leaders of a like cultural revolution, for lack of a better word, we each have to be doing that independently. We each have to be reckoning within ourselves how we uphold this celebrity culture, both in how we treat other people and how we treat ourselves as commodities within the space. And yeah, figuring that out is the only pathway forward.
I'm a little bit more sympathetic towards people in this scenario, because like we use the internet how it's built for us to use, and the modern internet is built around platforms and public figures within that platforms being influencers, celebrities, streamers, that sort of stuff. So I think it's less a problem of like how people glom on to like individuals. That's, I think, a symptom of a larger internet like structure problem, and more the fact that the only way we know how to use the internet now is through things like following people on Twitch, subscribing to YouTube channels to tell us everything. Like if I can get on my pet soapbox, I think one of the big problems with like the common internet is that like it is taken advantage of to, like, generate two generations of people, large, like maybe three, that don't have much media literacy, that are not taught. And the public education system in the United States was never going to be able to adequately teach them how to engage with the internet in a way that is like critical and thoughtful and sort of skeptical as a first step. Instead, we get people who say they have their best interests at heart, and we believe them because they're individuals like us. Oh, and they're also aspirational. There's an element of like American bootstrapism that runs through all of this, I think. So tabletop RPGs, because we lack that professionalism, we lacked a sort of like pipeline of becoming an indie developer, getting hired by a small corporation that like, or a small studio that then like you get a job at say Gearbox or Activision or any of these other companies. It is just, you are an indie artist and you get one of maybe three jobs a year at these AA studios, or you get captured by Hasbro and then you disappear into that machine and we never hear from you again until there's layoffs right before the holidays. So like, what else is there but to look to the people who say they have made it, to look to the folks online who have made their entire brand to be like, I am a successful person online, and be like, that could be me. They obviously haven't figured out, what can I do? And in lieu of that, my one path to success is to like create a community around these people whose job is to be successful online. They're not creating community. Twitter, Twitch, a Discord, those are not communities. Those are just like groups of people who all have a shared sort of consumer interest in a product and a brand. Like, that's just the way the internet works. So I think Rowan's right in that, like, the way that tabletop is going to change is by just sort of like breaking out of this model. Cause I think like it's an analog project. It's an analog product and a collaborative, creative medium that just does not fit well with the way we sort of like corporatize products and brands in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that what you said, so right when it comes to, it's almost like we're going back into like sort of a digital feudalism where we have these places like Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, Amazon, whatever it is, that hold all the like digital land that we then all toil on.
Anyway, content mines.
Bring back websites and forums.
If you want to find a website, you can subscribe to a website called rascal.news.
It's a great one. I've heard about that one somewhere. All right, we're starting to come to the end of our time together, so I want to throw one to you both that I think is just fun, which is, what is the current state in your mind of Hasbro And what is the future when it comes to this? Like, what might the future hold for this kind of corporate entity? Because we have D&D as a license, essentially, is where they want to go with it. There's also some of the subsidiaries that are looking a little iffy when it comes to like D&D Beyond, like what's going to happen there. And when it comes to new additions with the mismanagement of a lot of these rollouts, it just everything kind of seems murky. So go at it. What do you think? What are your predictions when it comes to Hasbro and the D&D property? Do you think they're going to spin it off to try to make some money back and it becomes a smaller studio again? Do you think that they're going to sell it to another mega studio? What do you think is in the future?
They'll probably keep getting money from the PIF.
Yeah. They'll certainly do that. I mean, it's digital. Like, you can look back. I'm actually just writing up a piece now about sort of like Chris Cox, the CEO of Hasbro, and like how his legacy is now, like, and the sort of reason why he was put into the CEO position is sort of coming to the fore and will be the sort of like rudder on Hasbro's ship over the next 5 years. He started in Xbox and Microsoft, and he's always been a digital guy and a brands guy. And when he was brought on to Hasbro in 2022, his big vision was to pivot their biggest brand towards a digital model, which meant entertainment with movies like Transformers and D&D and all this sort of stuff, and video games. They're not doing that very successfully, I will say. If you look at the sort of projects that have come out of Hasbro's both internal studios, the 4 or 5 internal video game studios, and then the licensed studios, they have one win in their belt. And that was not really by their design. That was because Larian was given enough time and leeway to make a good game. And it sort of, even then, it was a surprise hit. Like, no one sort of expected Baldur's Gate to be such a critical mass success. I think with the sort of dire straits that the company at large is, because its toy division is not doing well, like, you know, Play-Doh, Nerf, Transformers, like Peppa Pig does well because there's always going to be babies to watch Peppa Pig. But beyond that, like, they're trying to squeeze as much blood from the rock that is Magic the Gathering and D&D as possible. The problem is, and I think one thing that maybe it's going to be an uncomfortable truth for a lot of like Hasbro haters and tabletop folks, is that like D&D doesn't actually make them that much money. Like, it's fine, but it doesn't do well. So I think the future is they're going to monetize D&D as a brand. That's why they brought in D&D Beyond. It's a digital service. They can sell subscriptions. They can sell licensed stuff. They can sell a lot of stuff that is not physical books that have to be made out of paper and then shipped on barges to other parts of the world. And their margins begin to look really slim if it's just licensed material released digitally to a platform and a subscription that you pay for monthly. That's a much sweeter deal to them than physical books. So I think that's probably what we're going to be looking at is D&D with 2024. They can now have a sort of baseline sort of like set of assumptions for what this game looks like. They can update it as often as they want. They can get you to play on D&D Beyond. They're working on their own virtual tabletop. Like, they are trying to get away from physical D&D as much as possible, because then digital assets are easy to make, especially if you are cozying up to AI, like Chris Cox has said so in an interview with VentureBeat recently. So cynically speaking, it's online, it is less creative, and it's more sort of like content for the brand, capital C, capital B.
Yeah.
To paraphrase famous fantasy author Ursula K. Le Guin, D&D seems inescapable, but so did the divine right of kings, you know?
Is that a direct quote from her?
Yeah, I think so. I've heard that somewhere too.
Pretty sure, yeah.
Damn, she never missed.
Thank you both so much. Yeah, she really on point throughout her entire career. Rowan, Chase, this has been a blast. Thank you so much for coming on Tabletopped. I want to also leave people with how they can get involved with Rascal. What is like the best way for them to start consuming Rascal content, to be involved with the Rascal community? Like, what is the best endpoint to Rascal?
Yeah, well, I think the best part, if you are a creator who also makes things, who wants people to know about your things and have discoverability, we have our community announcement section where you can send your announcements for new games, new actual plays, casting calls, job postings, anything that you are doing that you want people to know about. You can email us at press@rascal.news, and we will set you up with a contributor account, and you will in perpetuity be able to post your own press releases that will be screened by us and then posted publicly for free for anyone to access.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And if people want to get involved as a reader and start giving you guys that money, how do they do
yeah.
that?
Yeah, so you can go to rascal.news. That's the URL. it's right there. And we have different subscription models. Like we try to put out a couple articles for free for just like free people, members. You just give us your email and then you can access that sort of stuff. That way we can also send you like newsletters and updates and that sort of stuff. We also have like party members for like $5 a month. And then we've got like some larger subscription models past then. But the $5 a month tier is what gives you access to almost everything that we do at Rascal. As far as social media goes, the best place to follow us is on Twitter, where I think is it at Rascal dot at Rascal News, Rascal _ News? What's our actual?
At Rascal _ News.
That's what it is. Okay. And then we're also on Blue Sky, but that's like the two social media places that we're really staking out. I'm spooling up a Discord here in the near future, as much as I don't like Discords. Like, it's nice to have like a little community space. So look forward to that in the future. But website, rascal.news. Hit us up on Twitter.
We also have a TikTok at Rascal News. Mm. And also, if you are not able to subscribe for a full month subscription, like Chase and I have real bad ADHD and have subscriptions that we are still paying for that we do not use, we don't want to do that to you. If you want to just read individual articles, we have a single paper article option available. So if you want to just check some things out to be like, let's just like test it out the waters a little bit, see if we like the writing. You can do that. And then if you feel so compelled, if you feel like our work is worthy of your hard-earned dollar, then you can subscribe monthly.
Hell yeah. Rowan, Chase, thank you so much for coming on Tabletop. This was a blast, and I can't wait to see what Rascal does next. Oh, man, right at the end. Come on.
You crushed it. Just like that ad read.
And everybody, if you really like this interview and want to hear more, you can always come back to Tabletop. We release every Monday on anywhere you get your podcasts. All right. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.